me dry. There was so much water, I couldn't believe my eyes. And I was worried about my family, will they be alright? Will they make it on the island for another night? Oh, people thirsty, dying by the roadside. Oh, and jumping off the bridge, committing suicide. Babies crying, mama.
Many nations around the world have incorporated human rights provisions into their legal framework and now provide more basic rights to their people than the United States. In key instances, international human rights standards are broader and more protective than the U.S. Constitution or domestic civil rights laws. At this moment in history, the notion of applying a universal human rights framework to the United States seems to be striking a chord with activists around the country.
What do we want?
Human rights!
Where do we want it?
Now!
I think human rights are important, especially for young people, because it shows how people that don't know their human rights are being violated every day. Young people should also get involved in the human rights because you don't have to be an adult to change the world.
To you, we speak the truth. To you, we speak the truth.
This is Ajamu Baraka, Executive Director of the U.S. Human Rights Network, and you're listening to No Retreat, No Retreat, Compromise.
No Retreat, No Compromise.
December 18th marks International Migrants Day. The United States has yet to ratify the International Convention on the Protection of the Rights of All Migrant Workers and Their Families. The U.S. Human Rights Network first biannual conference, which took place shortly after Hurricane Katrina and Rita demolished the Gulf Coast. Sonji Hart with the Juvenile Justice Project of Louisiana spoke about the need to expand the use of civil rights and recognize that citizenship does not guarantee full protection under the law, especially for people of color, the incarcerated, and migrants. She makes the case that the migrants' struggle and prisoners' struggle in the U.S. prove that a human rights framework must be applied in order to ensure dignity for all. In this podcast, you will also be hearing from John V.F. Williams, Executive Director of the Latin American and Caribbean Community Center. In June 2007, the first U.S. social forum took place in Atlanta, Georgia. John V.F.'s workshop on race and migration focused on the human rights implication of forced migrations and examines the danger of migrant and immigrant movements throughout the continent that do not critically incorporate a race and gender analysis.
Good evening. It is going to be hard to follow because I'm going to feel very quiet. But my name is Solchi and I work with families and friends of Louisiana's incarcerated children, and I'm very honored, a little out of place I feel, but very honored to be speaking with this group of people. And I want to thank Keith and Ajamu for having me here and other folks, but also to Atlanta, because I'm not the only one who has been able to take refuge here since being evacuated from New Orleans. I was surprised initially when I was asked to speak, because actually I'm very new to the conversation around human rights in this country. But I think I'm here because I've been speaking out a lot lately about what happens and is still happening to our members and families and communities in the Gulf Coast, particularly in New Orleans since the storms hit. And I've been specifically talking and thinking about how the nature of the horrors that occurred have forced many of us to consider that our resistance and our vision for the movement from this point forward lies outside the traditional realm of civil rights, and outside the confining notion of rights of citizens and citizenship, and certainly beyond remedies that any of us now trust this government to implement. So many of us lawyers and organizers and activists, I think we're beginning at this moment to ask ourselves, how is it that we can really move forward with this struggle with an international and human rights framework, and how can we use that framework to help guide us in the choices that we now have in the fight for a just reconstruction of New Orleans and cities like it. So let me say, I imagine there's many people in this country and many people in this room who long knew that that framework was the one we needed, but for some of us, it actually is still a growing understanding. And I know I don't have that much time. I tell people I'm a lot better at speaking concretely and leaving the analysis to somebody else, so I just want to talk about two pieces in particular of the horrors of Katrina and Rita and what they brought to light. They're both lesser known issues and less popular topics to talk about, but I think they're very illuminating in this conversation. The first is the criminal justice system and the abandonment of prisoners, both juvenile and adults. And the second is the intentional pitting against one another immigrants, and particularly Latino immigrants, and African Americans in the discussion of jobs during Reconstruction. So I wanted to tell, first of all, back in the days directly following Katrina, when folks all over this country watched in horror as New Orleans drowned and poor black New Orleanians were abandoned to die in the streets and in the Superdome and outside the convention center, FLIC staff and allies made a plan to go from shelter to shelter. And we were searching for the family members of young people who were locked up or detained in New Orleans and Jefferson Parish when the storm hit. That is the work, that is part of the work that we do normally, stay connected to those families. And our goal was to actually connect the children and their families, because through our work with the Office of Youth Development, we knew that there were 240 young people who had been evacuated to the main juvenile prison in Baton Rouge. And we knew that some of those folks, some of those young people had been evacuated properly the Saturday before the storm. We knew that others had arrived Thursday and Friday, fully 3 and 4 days after the storm. They arrived filthy, covered in sewage. They arrived with stories of standing in neck high in water for days and not having had food or water when they arrived. We knew that the kids had arrived with no paperwork, no proof of who they were. But we were working with the Office of Youth Development to identify the young people so that when we found families, we would be able to call our contacts and connect up the children and their families to let each other know that they were safe. And we learned a lot in those few days. We learned that there were mothers and grandmothers who had no idea where their children were or if they were safe. And we cried when we were successful in connecting them, but then told us the stories of how many other family members they were missing. We learned that in addition to the 240 young people who were evacuated, there were close to 10,000 adult prisoners, and I say adult because how many of them were 17 and 18 and 19, but who were largely left to die in Orleans Parish Prison. We learned then, and Human Rights Watch study verified it later, that the high-level guards simply walked off the job and left prisoners in their cells as the water rose. And the prisoners tell stories about how folks had to break out of cells by themselves and then lit blankets and mattresses on fire to hang outside the window to call for help. But help didn't come inside the building. If a prisoner, a person who was locked up, was lucky enough to make it out of their cell and out of the building, there was a bus on the overpass, and they were met at gunpoint and taken into custody and evacuated up to Angola Prison. So let me make that clear. Prisoners were left to die inside while rescue workers and law enforcement literally stood outside, waiting to grab the folks who were lucky enough to make it out. As of last week, there were 300 plus unaccounted for prisoners, meaning when you match up the list of the names of folks before the storm and the folks who were evacuated after the storm, there are 300 people who are not accounted for. The Sheriff Fessman, Attorney General Foti, they deny the whole thing. Sheriff Fessman has said they're criminals. Of course they lie. In the face of the fact that prisoners, family members, and many guards are actually telling the same stories. Attorney General Foti, you may have heard, because he took a great stand to prosecute the nursing home that let folks die inside of there. Well, many people don't know that he is not going to do anything unless made to about the prisoners who died in Orleans Parish Prison, a death trap that he built in his tenure as the sheriff of Orleans Parish. So let me just jump quickly to the second part, and that is that last week, I believe it was last week, the week before, the same week that Mayor Ray Nagin was applauded in his city council meeting for asking, how do I make sure New Orleans is not overrun with Mexican workers? My colleague, Hector Linares, went out into the streets of the French Quarter to talk to the workers about conditions. Everyone knew that conditions were not good. Even CNN had just recently reported they clear rotten seafood from stinking restaurant freezers, wash excrement from the floors of the Superdome, rip out wads of soaked insulation. Many of the workers in New Orleans are illegal immigrants who are being exploited and subjected to harsh living and working conditions. And it was known that while some cleanup workers were staying in hotels, others are sleeping in fields or squatting in abandoned buildings and working without mandated protective gear or clothing. But what Edward did not plan on discovering was that not only were conditions horrific, but folks aren't even being paid. He expected to approach people and have people not want to speak for fear of losing their job. But people, he said, came in groups to him because folks had been brought there and literally not paid in 3 weeks. They had been told to come, their passports had been taken by the folks who were employing them, and they did not have food, and they were literally hungry. And at this point, I think my most important piece is to talk about why are these two stories for me very linked and what they have to do with human rights. And that is that in this country, our country's notion of what constitutional civil rights are, what you have, are based on your status as a citizen. But the notion of citizenship was from the start in this country and is fundamentally racialized and vulnerable to the white establishment's redefining and narrowly defining the concept. So you have the set of rights granted to you unless by chance you are a prisoner or by chance you are an undocumented worker. And if you come from a community, then actually because you are poor and black, you are a criminal. And because you are poor and brown, you are illegal. Then how does the citizenship and the rights that are linked to that apply to you? We are so ingrained, however, into working within this, and I know people saw on TV in those awful days before folks were finally evacuated, the woman who stood outside the Superdome, and she was shouting at the TV cameras, "We're Americans! We're Americans!" Because the understanding is, as an American, you should have your rights respected. You should not be abandoned to die. You should not be intentionally kept inside a city that is filling with water. But we need to be able to switch our concept of what it is that brings those rights, of what it is that makes us worthy to live, of what it is that means that we deserve to live full lives, to not be hungry, to not be tired, to not be drowning. And I think we need to know that as long as we're stuck inside a framework that talks about civil rights and citizenship, then we will fight over those rights and we will miss the broader concept of human rights.
Well, thank you for being here. My name is Jean-Pierre Williams. I'm the Executive Director of the Latin American and Caribbean Community Center and the Director of Programs and Network Operations of the U.S. Human Rights Network. And the reason that we're organizing this race and migration panel is because a lot of, even when we talk about migration and immigration and migrant rights, a lot of times, most times, race is taken out of it or left out of it. And it becomes very generic and very general without really recognizing the different racial makeup that as people we make up, you know, people from different areas that migrate to the United States and to Canada and other capitalistic countries looking for better opportunities due to foreign policies that affect the region. So it's a very complex issue. How it's going to work, how we discuss here, is that I'm just going to lay out the framework, basically, very quickly, and then we'll give room to our presenters. And with us today, we have Rosa Lozano and Canet, who are both part of the DC Committee for Immigrant Rights. And Rosa is the coordinator for the FMLN Youth DC chapter, and she's also involved with the street theater troupe that we just saw. And then Mr. Cajus, who is part of the Haitian Women's organization from Haiti, and he's going to talk a little bit about race and racism within Haiti and the migration that takes place in the region. So, as I said, I'm just going to lay the groundwork and the framework, and then we'll go into the presenters. And we would like to have then a few minutes for discussions, for questions and answers, but we want to really leave here with sort of a strategy. How can we work in our communities and within our organizations to really look at race as an integral part of migration and not just as a general, human beings migrate because of ABC and not really, and make us invisible within the movement and within migration. So, and I usually write, so don't, I'm just going to be looking down a little bit, so don't think I'm not making eye contact with you. So, presently there are political borders between the United States, Latin America, and the Caribbean. And these politics of control are manifested through control of the borders, National Guard, passports, visas, retinal imaging, fingerprinting, repressive migration policies, and the daily laws that remind us that the state and nation determine not who comes in and out of each country, but who is valuable within each country and who really belongs to each country. Like the flow of private capital, the ideology of racism does not recognize any national border either, nor does it respect the sovereignty of communities in any country or any part of the hemisphere. So we have to revise our relationship between North America, Latin America, and the Caribbean, and specifically how it refers to the flow of racial biases and ideas today. So this discussion today is going to inform by the present process of globalization that has as objective to deepen the inheritance of slavery across all races now, suffering and deepen the inheritance of suffering and struggle of every single community. So in order to do this, we have to examine two things. The first one is the present construction and the definitions that have been attributed to being African descendant in the Americas. And we also must acknowledge and respect that indigenous, Asian, and African migrations, amongst others, into this continent have also molded the ways that we think about race and racism and how we structure race to structure our social relationships. And that's not only in the United States, it's in our home, in our countries of origin as well, and our daily interactions. So we have to be clear the impact of migration of African descendants in Latin America and the Caribbean, but also about the traditional race ideologies and about race and social hierarchies within the entire hemisphere. I'm just going to go through some examples. In the 1980s, the U.S. government promised to use forces, all the forces that it had at its disposition to do away with racial profiling. But in the 1990s, that same government applied pressure through racist policies and deportations to undocumented people. African Americans and Latino communities, as well as other racial minority groups, have always had common preoccupations of how the government used race as method to apply immigration law, as well as within the criminal punishment system. Now let's take another example, and that's September 11, 2001. This dramatically affected how collectively this country thought about racial profiling. The supposed efforts to eradicate racial profiling were now being questioned by people in the United States. Many people justified the use of racial profiling as a method to control terrorism and national security. And now that became a priority, and on top of that, it became a priority, and less of a priority was the protection of citizens and residents of this country that were of Arab, Muslim, Asian, indigenous, African American, Africans from the continent, Latinos, and other descendant people. So the security became to really protect white folks. The use of racial profiling is central to the public policies of capitalistic countries to follow up with migration laws. The border policies that we have permit racial profiling. The U.S. government has the authority to do this, to search and question people without justification. There was a few. There was a case a few years ago where a female U.S. citizen that was originally from Brazil was searched at the airport by two immigration agents without due cause. And the justification was that their job is to secure all ports of entry to the United States, even though that criteria was blatantly specifically about race. Now, the United States is not the only country, though. Incidents in the hemisphere prove to us that our own countries also contribute to racist ideology. Incidents and laws like the ones in the 1990s, while we saw our brothers and sisters from Haiti fleeing, they were stopped and returned by the U.S. government. And what happened here is that the U.S. government then put pressure on other countries, like República Dominicana, that had massive deportations of our own brothers and sisters from Haiti. Let's talk about Costa Rica as well, that changed their immigration laws so that Haitians couldn't come in. And let's talk about Panama too, where Haitian people still live in very repressive conditions. And this also this was in the 1990s. Now let's look at Amadou Diallo, an immigrant from Senegal that was shot 41 times in New York City. And right after the trains were bombed in London two years ago, an Afro-Brazilian brother was shot 7 times just because he was assumed to be a terrorist. So these examines are not only in the United States. The visible consequence of neoliberalism has given significance to the demolition of the social contract in which the common good depends on. This is exemplified by unemployment, reduction of social services, extreme poverty, lack of education, and violence against women in every single African-descending community throughout the American continent, and the Caribbean as well, of course. In relation to our experience as African-descendant migrants in the United States, then, what does it really mean to be African-descendant in this country, where our African-American brothers and sisters are not considered a valuable and active part of society? So our question then that I want to pose is then, what does it mean to be not white in this country? What does it mean to not have European ancestry and be in this country? The racial differences that have not been resolved nor addressed in our countries of origin will also continue to divide all our communities as we migrate. And I'm specifically talking because it's my experience within the Latino community. That for the Latino community, for the most part, does not respect or acknowledge race. And it will continue to divide the Latino community. Inside the core of the Latino community will continue to be divided if there's not a race analysis that's applied to every single aspect of what we talk about. And also, the Latino community pretends to create solidarity with African American communities. Until there is no recognition of race within our own communities, there will be no solidarity with diverse migrant communities and the historical local African-American communities. So let's not pretend anymore. Many people bring with them ideas of race that are founded in white supremacy. The struggle must continue within our own communities in the Americas to confront racist expressions and contradictory material that are a direct result of the super-duper-duper exploitation of our race. So the discussion today around migration and of migrant workers in North America and Europe are only symptoms of a sickness that has infected every single community. And believe it or not, including the social forum and including this room. And that is the white supremacist, racist, patriarchal, and global system. The effects of this system must be discussed openly on an international, national, community, and a family level, with the context being urgency. The creation and development of effective social movements in any of our countries requires a direct assault of white supremacy ideology. No social movement process, nor any revolution can ever be successful without the full, complete, and transversal participation and without the interest of us, the sons and daughters of Africa. These are historical lessons that they inform us of the hard, difficult, and honest work that we have always had to look towards. Only when we eradicate all the sick ideas that we have been taught and we create a movement based on popular action, only and only then will we create the changes in society that history needs us and wants us to create. So, thank you very much.
Underlying all human rights work in the United States is the commitment to challenge a belief that the United States is inherently superior to other countries of the world, and that neither the U.S. government nor the U.S. rights movement have anything to gain from the domestic application of human rights. Network members believe that the U.S. government should no longer be allowed to shield itself from accountability to human rights norms, and that the U.S. civil, disability, women's, workers, immigrant, LGBTQ, prisoner impunity, and other rights movements that stand to benefit perhaps now more than ever from an end to U.S. impunity in this regard. For more information on how to join the U.S. Human Rights Network, visit us online at www.ushrnetwork.org. Human Rights No Retreat, No Compromise podcast is a production of the U.S. Human Rights Network, produced by Ajamu Baraka, Sunyata Altenor, and John B.F. Williams, with Sugar Matthews, Tonya Williams, Drina Brown, Kalia Kunu, and Rachel Fowler. U.S. Human Rights Network at www.ushrnetwork.org.
In its wake, Katrina left a ravaged Gulf Coast and a nation shocked by the images of poverty and neglect that it revealed.
To the extent that the federal government didn't fully do its job right, I take responsibility.
And it was so wrong, yeah. Uh-oh.